This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Welcome to Going In Blind. I'm your host, Zach Tidwell. And today we're going to be talking about a little bit of bumping uglies, a little bit of swapping bodily fluids, and probably a whole lot of loving. Hopefully not spreading any diseases, but that's because my guest today is a sexologist, and I'm sure we're probably going to get into some spicy territory here, but I have about 12 million questions that I want to ask her, so I'm very, very excited for this. Before we get into that, just a couple quick announcements. You guys have already heard me rant about this, but I do have a memoir on the way. If you're unfamiliar with my story, head over to ZachTidwell.com and read the little bit about me there, and so you can see what that is all about. I don't have a release date for it yet, but it is on the way, and I have a newsletter there that you can join to get any future announcements about that. Also, if you've been listening for a while, please take a second to rate and review the show wherever you're listening, and if that's on YouTube, go ahead and subscribe and then share these things around. That really helps this thing get boosted in the algorithms and help new people find these conversations, because if you go back through the backlog, we've had some pretty heavy, heavy topics covered here that people do need to hear about. Like these, this is how we grow as a society and grow as individuals. So with all of my usual spiel out of the way, please welcome, and this is her real name, please welcome Dr. Holly Wood. How are you, Holly?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So I actually saw when I was doing my research on you. Are you still in San Clemente?
I am.
I was stationed on Camp Pendleton on the very north end. Cristianitos Road, how that leads, that little tucked away gate, like my side of base was right there. So I'm very familiar with that area and I love it out there.
Yeah. It's a really great little beach town right there.
Yeah, and I honestly probably could have used your services several years ago. So in back in 2017, when I was on my second deployment, I found out that my wife was cheating on me, and we tried to make things work when I got back, and it didn't, as those things tend not to. And that's actually one of the myriad things that I want to ask you about today is as we get farther into this, is some of that recovering from infidelity and stuff like that. But I think a great place to start is probably you telling everyone exactly what a sexologist does, because even I didn't know, and I really had to like dig into this, because it's like one of those things, I think when you hear it, you're like, all right, what's going on here? And then I saw PhD and all of these other certifications that you have, and like, oh, this is a real thing. This is not some random person throwing themselves out as a sex coach. I mean, you are a real therapist. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So the term sexologist is not really popular in the United States. It's more of a popular term in different countries, but I mean, obviously breaking it down, just one who studies sex. I tend to identify myself as a clinical sexologist, meaning that I do study sex and I also work in a clinical setting, meaning with clients. And so I'm much ascribed to what's called like a scholar practitioner model, where so much of my work is informed by evidence-based research and practices. So I really try to combine those two things. But yes, to your point, I have a bunch of pieces of paper and letters after my name. So I am a licensed marriage and family therapist, an asex certified sex therapist, and my PhD is in human sexuality.
Okay. And that was going to be my question, because I wasn't able to track down what your PhD was actually in. So was that when you set out to get your education, was that your goal, or did you, something else led you down that road?
Yeah, no. So that was not my goal. How I got there was, I actually went to school pre-med. So I wanted to do like reconstructive surgery. It was like, Dr. 90210 and like all those shows were really popular when I was a kid.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, like doing that, or like reconstructing, you know, like cleft palates and things like that. And then I was in undergrad, I think in my sixth chemistry class. And I was like, this is really like, when does the doctor ever pull out the periodic table? Like, why are we still like looking at this? I started to get really bored, actually. And then I took a gender and sexuality class just as a breath requirement. And I was like, oh, I really like this. So it's doing that. I then had some personal experiences related to sexual violence, and then started volunteering at the local rape crisis center. And then the next piece of this, and I promise this is going somewhere, is that I was working and going to school in my undergraduate career. And so in order to have a second job and still go to school, I had to have a job that was open overnight. So I started moonlighting at the adult toy store. So
nice.
Full circle. And I call that like my first taste of couples therapy, right? Couples would come in asking me for help with certain things. And I was like, oh, this is like kind of like couples therapy.
Yeah.
And that's actually what sparked everything. So full circle, I decided I still finished out my biology major, but also added a gender and sexuality major. And then I was like, this is what I want to do. And combining all those different things, I want to work with survivors who've experienced sexual violence and helping them engage in what I call like the fun stuff, like pleasurable sex again. So most of my work focuses on that population, but I see a whole host of folks.
And that's another thing I want to come back to that, because you said a couple things there I want to ask you about. But I actually recently had a professional dominatrix on here, and she works in she's not a clinician, but she tries, it is in a therapeutic capacity there. It is in tandem with a clinician. And this is like a movement that they're trying to start. And I had never, that conversation with her was very eye-opening. It was entirely not what I expected. And it was very, very informative, and had never even stopped to consider how someone might process a rape or other sexual violence. And it's one of those things, because it's so horrendous and we hear about it. And then because it is so horrendous, you're not going to prod and ask questions. And it's just, so hearing that from someone who helps people like that, like you do, and I want to come back to that, is just, I'm very interested by it. And I think, again, that people hearing how some of that works is very, very valuable. But you mentioned, I had never heard of a rape crisis center. Is that you're called in for support after someone has been victimized?
Yeah. So there's a couple different jobs you can hold as a rape crisis advocate. So one of which is you're working on a hotline. So if somebody calls and wants to talk to somebody just for support or for resources, then you can connect them while you're speaking on the phone. And then the other way is where, and I would usually do this one, is somebody would call and report a sexual assault, and then they would come in to the hospital for a SART exam, or what we call it, what's known as like a rape kit, essentially. So they would go to the hospital, and I would meet, as a volunteer or an advocate, I would meet that person at the hospital just to be a support person there with them throughout the whole process. So most of the time, these people are coming in to have this very invasive exam done alone. And the nurses that I worked with were always lovely, but still they don't have somebody just like there as their support person. So I would just be there, sit with them all night, grab them food if they needed, and also like provide them resources for next steps.
And that's again, something I'd never thought about, but after having something like that happen and then having to go into the hospital to have one of these tests done is like, all right, now we're going to invade more.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be horrible. Do you feel for you is getting into that role and being able to help other people through that, did that help you process some of your own things that you had to deal with?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in like the continued work that I do, right? It's like turning pain into passion or doing something to be of service to others that I can understand.
Yeah. And that's, I get this because I do this on the suicide side and the mental health side. But I think I've never realized it, but like this is almost, I think, because sex is attached to it. And obviously rape is another thing entirely because it is so, it's such a personal thing. Like there's sex in and of itself, like specifically in America, is like not a very talked about thing. And then
this podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts, but not just any gifts, real gifts, thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Obviously, that is a horrendously traumatic thing that people don't talk about. And so I've never been able to ask someone who's been through it and been able to help others through it. Like, it's yeah. Very intriguing to me. But is that, so moving forward, as you continued with the education, because I've never, you said it's a PhD in human, what is it? Human
sexuality.
Sexuality. Mm-hmm. Is there a pretty lean number of programs out there for you to get
yes.
that in?
Yes. There's more now, but as far as my understanding is, there are only two accredited programs that offer a PhD. You can get a PhD from another institution that's not accredited, but for me, that was important. So there was either San Francisco or Widener, Pennsylvania, and I chose San Francisco because that was closer and warmer.
Yeah, that's Pennsylvania. That could be rough. Like the East Coast people in general, you don't hear about Pennsylvania being rough, but the winters out there it's gross. I think you made the right call. So, in doing that, was your intent as you decided to pursue your PhD to specifically get in on the trauma side of things?
Well, I was already doing the work. So to be a sex therapist, you have to be a certified sex therapist because the field of sex therapy is not super regulated. So this is important for people to know if they're looking for a sex therapist as well. Like anybody who is a licensed therapist can call themselves a sex therapist, but that doesn't mean that they are trained to do so. So sex therapy certification is a post-master certification, meaning you have to be a licensed therapist first, and then you do an additional amount of hours of supervision, of client work and training to then get this certification in sex therapy specifically. So I was already doing the work. I knew I wanted to be a sex therapist, and I knew the path to get there. I was already doing the trauma work. The PhD in addition was more so I can contribute to the larger body of knowledge of like all this, you know, research that I'm getting to read as an academic. It's like, oh, I can actually be a part of creating this research, which is really exciting.
Yeah. And that's with the lack of regulation. Do you know why that is? Is there a consensus on that?
I do not know, actually. Okay. I'm not entirely sure. But if somebody is looking for, I get like someone can call themselves a trauma therapist. Someone can call themselves like all these different specialties, right? But it doesn't necessarily mean they have done additional certification or training in that area.
They're just so flavoring their title almost.
And that might actually be the work that they do. That might be the bulk of the work that they do is like specifically trauma or specifically I'm an anxiety therapist or something like that. But yeah, if for folks who are ever looking for a sex therapist, I would always recommend like asking if they're certified, or you could probably see that on their website somewhere if they are.
Go to drhollywood.com to get services.
Yeah, you can do that too.
Well, and you, you've got a YouTube channel now too that you're getting into. You want to tell everybody what that is before we move along so they can go check it out?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. So like you, I'm trying to get good information out there to everybody. I always say I went to school for a long time and paid a lot of money to get this information. So I want to share it with everybody in a way that's accessible. So yeah, if you want to learn more about sex, relationships, and mental health, by all means, please do check out my YouTube, and that's at The Hollywood Sexologist.
There we go. And so now I want to start digging into this stuff.
Yeah.
Is, I guess, I think to dig in first, since the traumatic side of things is your specialty, kind of, like how do you even approach that with someone? Is it typically individuals that are coming in who have experienced these things in the past, or couples where a line was crossed? And I know that doesn't even feel like a good way to word that question, because there shouldn't be a couple where that's the case that's going on. But what does that look like, both in someone coming in and then even how you start to work through that stuff?
Yeah. So typically it is individuals who are seeking support, and these might be people who are single, or they might be somebody who have a partner. They have like a loving, trusting partner that they logically feel safe with, but are having issues because the trauma is like resurfacing as it's held in their body. So even though they have this conscious awareness, they're still bumping up with some issues. And then sometimes it's a couple who sees me, and then we find out that this was in the past of one of them, because unfortunately sexual violence is so incredibly common. It's very likely that you're going to encounter somebody who has had that as part of their past. How that looks in the therapy room is, for one, it depends on where each person is at with their journey. Again, it's something that happens to so many people that it might be a part of their history, but that might not be what they're coming to see me for. And if that is what they are coming to see me for, or we surface together that this is something that's preventing them from accomplishing their other goals, then generally it works by, I try to start with making sure to do like triage, right? We want to take care of like any PTSD symptomology that might be happening, right? Make sure that they're stable, the patient is stable, before we transition into things that are, like I say, like tackling the fun stuff, right? Making it pleasurable again. Sometimes there's some overlap, certainly, because pleasure can be healing. But how that works in the therapy room, I don't know how much like therapy jargon into the weeds you want me to get.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. So generally what that looks like after we do assessment and treatment planning is, I'm a mixed methods type of clinician, meaning I tailor treatment to you using a mix of different evidence-based methodologies. And so sometimes that looks like EMDR or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy. Sometimes it looks like trauma-informed CBT. Sometimes it looks like mindfulness-based practices. And sometimes it looks like exposure therapy. And especially if they are in a relationship with somebody who, again, is trusting and they know to be safe, then we can incorporate more of those like exposure therapy practices where they're kind of using a ladder approach to get closer and closer to the thing that is scary.
It seems like that, and I'm not being silly here, like it seems like that would be a big part of that, because having sex again seems like it would be inherently traumatic, like in terms of pulling stuff back up. Is that pretty common?
Absolutely. And then, and usually the first part, unfortunately, there's so many people for whom's first sexual experience is actually a trauma that I find. And so also a big part of it is working to kind of separate sex from sexual violence, right? That's a big thing for me, is to separate the two of them, because if they're associating sex only with violence because their first experience was violent, and when I say violence, doesn't mean like that has to be like physically painful and abusive. I think violence can also be much more insidious. But if they've experienced some sort of sexual trauma and that's now associated with, well, that's kind of like tainted their whole view of sex, like a big thing is like naming that this was a trauma or this was violence. And sex, when I say the word sex, sex to me is inherently consensual.
Yes.
Sexual violence isn't.
Yeah, I mean, I've going to be as vague as possible here. I know someone who I'm very close with who has been through a lot of, and it seems to have permanently altered this person's life, even though they are in an incredible relationship now. Like, and not, obviously, there any sort of event like that is going to be life-changing, but I mean, in terms of lasting, heavy, heavy lasting effects even now. And it's just, again, that's the only person that I know personally that has ever, you know, expressed that they've been through that. And it has made me think of that, where it is like, how the hell do you move on after that? Because it is, we're humans. Like, we need sex as part of having a healthy life. It is part of having a healthy relationship. And again, with it, that's like.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
That's like with people, you know, if you're addicted to food and you have to get over a food addiction, but you still have to eat, it's like, how do you even do that? And that's another one of the things I wanted to ask you about, was, you know, sex addiction being a thing. Like, it's, again, being in the addiction space with having struggled with alcoholism, people struggling with sex addiction has come up, you know, from time to time. And it's just, on one hand, as just like, you're almost like, really? I mean, I love sex too, but it's obviously, it's when it's an addiction, it is starting to become, it's like this maladaptive thing that is starting to have negative effects on the rest of your life. But how do you treat something like that?
Yeah. So a couple things. One of which, for a lot of people, yeah, sex is a healthy part of their lives. And for some people, they don't want that to be a part of their lives. And I see folks like that too. When it comes to sex addiction, I think this, how do I say this? I don't use that phrase. And that's for a couple of reasons. I aligned with a sex position on sex addiction, ASEX, meaning the American Association for Sexuality Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, really long acronym, but that's like the main governing board of sex therapists in the U.S. And I align with them in that they don't ascribe to the use of sex addiction, because there's just not enough evidence in how it aligns with other addictions that makes sense, although it can certainly feel like an addiction for people. So I don't want to downplay that or dismiss that. It can certainly feel like an addiction. It can feel compulsive, right? And so I ascribe to what's called like out of control sexual behaviors or compulsive sexual behaviors. So when people see me for things like that, I use what's called like an OCSB or out of control sexual behavior model, in which we really assess for all the things that might be impacting this. So for example, we notice a lot of comorbidity of compulsive sexual behaviors with ADHD, right? They're like dopamine seeking, or they're using that to soothe, which makes a lot of sense. Sometimes there's like an overlap association with like narcissistic personality disorder. So we want to figure that out too. Sometimes there's a trauma piece, right? Sometimes people act out hypersexually because it gives them a sense of control in contrast to their experience of sexual trauma.
Wow.
So when working with folks like that, I generally try and figure out the root and then try and increase other more adaptive behaviors.
What would that look like in terms of, instead of trying to seek a partner, you're trying to find a more healthy outlet for that energy? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
How common is something? Yeah. Oh, you go ahead.
I don't know the numbers. That's a good question. Like on sexual compulsivity, I'm not sure of the numbers.
But what, before I started talking, what were you going to say? Yeah.
Oh, I think it escaped me. I'm so sorry. It escaped me.
No, you're fine. I didn't realize. I thought you had paused and were waiting for me to say something. And then as I started asking, I was like, damn it, I'm talking over.
But that's okay.
It's funny. It's especially with, I've had a couple guests who, you know, it's part of the nature of this and not doing the pre-show calls, because I don't do any of the pre-interview stuff because I don't want to then rehash some of the things that we've already talked about, because I want these to be genuine conversations. But I also don't get a hint of people's speech patterns before that. Yeah. And so a couple times I've had where people will take a longer time in between speaking and not being able to see it visually. I occasionally step on people's toes, so I apologize for that. But
oh, no worries at all.
I feel weird because typically these are more meandering conversations that I feel like I'm just asking you all of the big questions that I have. So if you have something you want to talk about, like, take it away. I have about a million things I could ask you about, and usually these questions will, you know, lead down another rabbit hole. But coming back also to, I think, and I guess in terms of what I touched on earlier, like with the infidelity side of things, you know, I tried recovering that with my wife, and I know, everyone knows people who've been cheated on, are cheating on someone, or like these couples who do somehow stay together after they're cheating. And sometimes it's even repetitive cheating, which is, that kind of blows my mind when it is a cycle that people seem to do. But, you know, the root of any relationship, or a huge root of it, is trust, right? And that's having that violated after something like that. Like, that wasn't something that I could reconcile. And I would guess that you probably have a lot of people coming in after something like that. Is that, especially
being a good amount.
Especially being right outside of Camp Pendleton, probably getting a lot of that.
You know what? I don't see a whole lot of military folks, even though I'm close. I don't. They don't find me.
Okay. Well, I guess that's probably, they don't really. I've received the enlisted paychecks before. You don't have a lot of wiggle room for disposable income.
Yeah. That's a kind of take what the VA will give you.
Yeah. It's so, when, outside of talking through things, like even, you know, I tried going to marital counseling with my ex-wife early on, and it wasn't productive. It was also, it was like our on base again. It was the, what my unit could give to me for me seeking counseling with this. And it was not productive whatsoever. So with you, when you, being that that is such a common thing, and there's probably someone listening or several people listening to this who are going through something like this right now, what are the common trends that you see? What are the steps forward outside of the abstract things? Like, how do you typically approach something like that?
Yeah. So in part, what one of my colleagues, Dr. Tammy Nelson, she says something. She works a lot with infidelity, and she'll say that, you know, infidelity can either mean a breakdown or a breakthrough. And I love thinking about and framing infidelity in that way, because it really can be a way to kind of shock the relationship into seeing like, okay, something was going on here, that something's wrong. And I like to figure out kind of like what some of the reasons are, right? So most of the time people engage in infidelity because they're feeling lonely, right? Something's happening in their relationship in which they are feeling disconnected from their partner. Maybe that's a physical distance. Mostly it's an emotional distance, right? Or maybe they're not feeling attractive or what have you. It's much more rare to see those like one night stand accidents as far as what shows up into my office. I will say more often than not, infidelity shows up in my office through consensual non-monogamy. So people will seek me out as they're looking to open up their relationship. However, they're trying to do this as a result of non-consensual non-monogamy, aka infidelity. And so they're like, oh, well, maybe this is why. Maybe we need to open up the relationship. And maybe, like for some people, that is the best route. For some people, they feel like, you know, they have more love or energy to give or want to experience other relationships in addition to the person that, let's say, they're married to. So sometimes that's the route. Other times, mostly what I like to focus on is rebuilding the emotional connection between partners so they can work through that betrayal, repair, and feel closer to each other.
Yeah, that's... I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because that was another thing I wanted to ask you about. Like, I don't know. I'm 29, so I don't know if it's being around other people my age, and this is more of a generational thing. I don't know if this is just something I've become aware of, and so now I notice it more. But there seems to be a big trend. I guess some of that I was also just realizing that's probably, you know, I've done the online dating thing and you see it on there a lot, or it's, hey, I'm married, but we date separately. He knows that I'm here kind of thing. And
this podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts, but not just any gifts, real gifts, thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Have you noticed that this is something culturally that is a shift that's going on, or is this something that you've kind of always seen? And I want to also keep this, or at least come back to touching on the infidelity, how this plays into coming back from the infidelity side, because that almost seems like a very touchy situation to try and recover your relationship from. But have you seen a shift towards that more in the population in general?
Yeah, I think there's just a lot more exposure to it now, right? Nowadays, everybody has a camera. Everybody can record things. And so there's like so many people being exposed to different relationship configurations and different ways of relating. Like, and I use non-monogamy as like an umbrella term, right? So there's people like, people have been doing this for quite some time, but we're seeing all the different variations more openly, whether it's like swinging or like this like kitchen table dynamic or different ways of engaging in polyamory or like, you know, doing things completely separate. Like we're married, but we're also dating completely separately. There are lots of different ways to do non-monogamy. And I think mostly because people have so much exposure to it now.
So do you get people coming in where that's where they've gotten the idea from? It is, oh, we saw, you know, X YouTuber talking about it, and so we want to give it a shot too.
Yeah, but it's usually, again, and just from the folks who I see in my office, it'll usually be a couple who's engaging non-consensual non-monogamy or infidelity, and then the partner who was engaging in infidelity says, you know, I've realized through this that I'm actually non-monogamous, right? That I orient that way. And when I say, like, almost like a sexual orientation, like they're like, I'm not just straight, but I'm non-monogamous, right?
To me seems like excusing some bad behavior. You're like,
and sometimes it is but sometimes not.
Gosh, how do you ride that line as the clinician where I get a ball in from that perspective of, okay, dude, no, you're making excuses here. And even if they're not, I mean, someone did get betrayed. Like there's still that. Is it more of being a listening ear for this stuff? Or I know you said you use EMDR for some of the traumatic stuff, or this from the outside looking in, this seems almost like a different lane there in terms of how you would have to handle that stuff.
Yeah. So with couples, I mainly orient towards like EFT or emotionally focused therapy. So it's really at challenging negative interaction patterns and helping couples to really like speak from their heart and new emotions and change these interaction patterns that they have to be more positive. So when it comes to like specifically somebody who's engaged in infidelity and now they're exploring non-monogamy, my thing is always like, whoa, 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 like, let's pump the brakes. I think about, like, you know, when people say, like, you know, oh, if your marriage isn't going well, like, the last thing that you want to do is, like, have a baby, right? And so I think about it like that. It's like, you know, having a baby isn't going to, like, fix a marriage, and neither is non-monogamy. And sometimes non-monogamy can be great, and people can do it really well. But I think it needs to be really thoughtful. I think any relationship you go into, whether that's monogamous or not, should be thoughtful. And so you have to really think through, can I give myself adequately to these other relationships? And is this also serving my current partnership? And so most of the time it's me telling couples to pump the brakes. Let's focus on what's happening between just these two people in the room. And then working with them to decide if that's something they want to enter into as a couple.
Yeah, it seems like part of me is, on one hand, I'm not the kind of person that would work for. That is just not, that wouldn't float my boat. I get that it does for other people, so it's hard for me to understand it. And the other side of it is like you said, that seems like very unstable ground to tread upon when you're in a situation like that, where it is just like, also like, goddamn, relationships are a lot of work, and now you want to like, I don't know, it's very interesting to me. And it is, again, it's like seeing that trend towards it to me is just, it's interesting. It's in our societies. I'll have to think about it with that, like what you said with it being more of an open or more access to information around it. I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, lots of folks coming in with different things that they've seen on TikTok, and sometimes it's, you know, clients who've seen me for years and go, oh, this person on TikTok said this. And I was like, I'm pretty sure I've been telling you that for a while, but okay, I'm glad TikTok got through to you.
At least,
but as long
message,
as the information gets, exactly, the message gets there.
That has to be so frustrating. I mean, that's like a parent telling your kid, like, you know, you need to brush your teeth every night or something. And then they go to the dentist and they're like, hey, dude, you have 12 cavities. You need to start brushing your teeth every night. And you see the change. You're like, what? What? Why were you listening to me? Is that something just in general that happens a lot as a therapist where you're like, I've been telling you this shit for 2 years?
Yeah. I mean, I try not to take it personally. I think if folks in the helping professions, I mean, I'll speak for myself, but I think I have a lot of colleagues who might say the same thing. And because we also, I consult with colleagues on a regular basis. We want you to heal as much as you do, right? Like when a client comes to us, like seeking support, we want you to get better. It's a bad business model that we want you to get better and then stop seeing us. Like, yeah. Yes, it's a bad business model, but we really do want that. My thing is, I was like, I want you to not need me anymore. So when it seems like a client gets to a place of like stuckness and maybe like it feels like I'm not doing enough or I'm not helping them, it's frustrating in that I take this work very seriously and I want people to feel better at the end of the day. That's what I want. And so that's where there's a little, but that's my own stuff, right? That's my own insecurities popping up that I'm not going to put onto the client. Something like TikTok, the bringing up what they saw on TikTok more so just makes me laugh, and I'm just happy that the information's getting there.
Yeah. Well, and as your channel grows, you'll probably, maybe someone will come in and be like, I saw you talking about this. Like,
oh gosh. Maybe.
Yeah. Is another thing here, like that I've seen, well, I guess, you know, I'm blind, so I'm not seeing it, but the trend, or at least it coming up more in the zeitgeist of specifically people saying porn addictions, but it also seeming to be, I don't know if it's a more talked about issue or if it is more of an issue for people. And again, it's like, okay, how much of it is there's been the rise of the more individual content creator doing stuff on things like OnlyFans. And so then it drives a wedge in relationships in that capacity, but, or is it just people viewing things that are very, you know, eventually take them to a place where they can't, they're so desensitized to normal, more just normal sex that doesn't do it for them anymore. Have you seen a trend in that direction, or is that just maybe inaccurate on my end that I'm seeing?
Yeah. So let me see if I can answer what you're asking. So with like porn use, again, I don't generally use the word addiction, but with like compulsive porn use, right? We have access. You probably have access to porn in the palm of your hand through your cell phone, right? Like, or through OnlyFans, right? We have so much more access. And so I think the most recent study I saw says like average age of like exposure to pornography is down to like age 9 or something. So we have this access, yes, which is very scary. So we have this access to pornography. And what happens is when I talk with folks who talk about problematic porn use, I'll describe this study. They did this study and essentially they put two rats into a cage, and these rats are new to each other. And so they start copulating at a really high rate. And then as time goes on, the rate of copulation goes down. And then they pluck out one rat and they put in a new sexy rat, and then the rate of copulation goes back up because they have this new shiny sexy rat in there. And then again, as time goes on, that rate of copulation slows down. They pluck that rat out.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF,
A vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, "I found it on The Real Real." Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Another sexy rat in. Ooh, new sexy rat. More sex happening again and again and again. And exactly. And so when folks are watching porn, it's essentially the same thing. They're getting exposed to this novelty, this new shiny thing with just a swipe. And so it's lighting up those areas of your brain. It's hitting all those good, like, dopamine receptors and having you feel those feel-good feelings and the reward center in your brain. So then, yeah, it can cause people to crave that sense of novelty. And it can also cause people to have unrealistic standards for real-life sex and intimacy. All right. It's like something you say in the sex therapy community is like, learning how to have sex by watching porn is like learning to drive by watching The Fast and the Furious. So people have this like very unrealistic standard. So that's what I see happening in terms of porn use. And I will also just like name, I think porn use can also be a really nice, like healthy additive to a couple's sex life, but shows up problematic in those ways.
Yeah. And that's, you know, in bringing that up, like, I think it's like anything else where, yes, you can overuse anything. Like, it's, I don't have, like, ethically, I don't, as long as, you know, no one's being manipulated into making that content and it's not going places it's not supposed to go. Like, an adult viewing porn made of consensual individuals having sex in whatever capacity, like, no one's getting hurt. I'm all for it. So I've the other side of that with me wondering about this more common, I guess, narrative that I'm hearing. And I've wondered how much of that is because you're starting to see places like Texas where it tends to be a lot of religious views bleeding over into political things moving. We're like, we're banning porn. And so how much of it is this narrative is coming out of things that are propagated by like that system and things like that. And so I was curious just from your, on your end to see if it really is something that is becoming more of an issue or if this is, again, just the, my reading is wrong on the room or, you know, my thermometer is reading it wrong, but because it, go ahead.
Well, becoming an issue. So I guess with that, I think like, who is it an issue for? Is it an issue for the individual because now they're struggling to engage in real life sex? Or is it an issue for like the state of Texas, right? So for example, the state of Texas would also not like me because I own more than 6 sex toys, which is, I think, their legal limit there. But what? That's a problem for Texas. That's not a problem for me.
Is that a real thing?
That is a real thing.
Oh my God. You're going to go out in the street and beat someone to death with 6 dildos, I guess, is the concern.
That...
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, again, it's like anything. Yeah. People go too far on either side of the aisle with stuff. And that's like a crazy one to me where I'm like, why are you limiting people's access to that? But it's just, I don't know, it's hard with everything, all the media that is out there, like outside of, you know, podcasts and obviously there's obviously podcasts and YouTube channels and individual content creators. Like it is, we've seen over the past several years that so much of it is artificial fake BS that is, and worse. I mean, companies and governments are doing it with AI where they're putting stuff out and like they're catching even foreign countries, which means we're also doing it. Our news just isn't talking about it. In terms of manipulating people to turn them against each other and against certain topics. And it's just, yeah, it's, I'm always, everything that I see is with a grain, or I take everything with a grain of salt, but it is, that's why I wanted to ask you about it specifically. It's just, it's hard to tell what's real. Like, it is so hard. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard. And like, I think especially as we're talking about, you know, porn use, like the stuff with AI is like really kind of scary how that might be used to alter things that we see in like that type of content. And also there's like really cool AI related sex tech that we can access too.
Yeah, what's your take on these sex robots and sex robot brothels that are starting to become a thing?
That's so interesting. For next week, actually, tomorrow. I don't even know what day it is. Tomorrow, I actually have a video scheduled to go up about owning sex dolls and sex robots. And like what that says about people psychologically.
Spill the beans.
I think the main thing that's problematic about that is that it usually when they study people who own sex dolls and sex robots, right? They all like psychologically, they're not dangerous, they're not violent people, but they do struggle with having real life relationships. And so my only concern about the use of these types of devices is, does that further create a wedge that like enables you to not work on building real life relationships? Like, it becomes a crutch essentially.
Yeah, and I think even more than that, like it's because if you're already having trouble with relationships, and this is, again, glad this came up. I wanted to ask you about, obviously, this is another thing we hear about specifically incel. And when I think of the phrase incel, I think of the very like almost extremist, like I hate women because I can't get laid kind of thing. So that is not, I'm staying away from using that because it's not what I'm talking about in this context. Specific, if you are someone who's having trouble with establishing relationships and getting to that point with other people, like it seems, yes, that is a crutch, but also like you're going to continue to regress if you are withdrawing from actually trying. And it's a weird spot where it is like, okay, if you are having that little of luck and it's your self-esteem is probably even worse as a result of that, and you feel like you can't get a win there, that is a very, very slippery slope. And it is hard because it's like, okay, well, if it is not working for you, then what else do you do? And I say that realizing that the reason they're having issues getting these relationships is because of other shortcomings, right? Like it is, whether that be socially, you're not taking care of yourself physically, you're not doing well enough in life in general to attract a mate that you are attracted to, that you are equally attracted to. Like, obviously there are other things there, but people don't, if you're that person who is then buying the sex robot, like it is, or even that there's, you know, like the real dolls and stuff like that, it is probably you're either not, don't have the self-awareness to recognize that, or you're not willing to make those changes.
Yeah, and I might be just like so incredibly scared, right? Like maybe you've had such poor experiences with like real life relationships that it almost feels like traumatic and you don't know how to work through that on your own, or maybe you don't know how to reach out for help with like a therapist to work on like engaging in relationships, build up those social skills, that this seems like the best option.
Is that something, if someone is in that position, where they would benefit from working with a sex therapist?
I think for like relationship skills training, I think too. I've had one client that has voiced to me that they had one of these real life dolls. And what was most shocking to me was not that he had a doll, but it was that he made this huge purchase. Huge in finances and huge as it's the size of a person, and has it hiding in the basement, and his wife didn't know about it. And so what was more concerning is like, oh goodness, like what is happening with your relationship that you feel so disconnected from your partner that you have to hide this thing and like have so much like shame around this thing, and you're getting connection. This is this person's experience, right? Getting connection from this doll that you feel like you can't get from your own wife.
That's, I hadn't even considered that being a possibility. I was thinking purely an individual who's just having a hard time with finding connection. And that is bonkers to me. But then that's, you know, obviously that's not the only instance of that happening.
Mm-hmm.
That is just, and I worry, I mean, obviously that is alarming from the perspective of the health of that relationship. Yes. Obviously not a good sign. At least he's not cheating on her with another human being, but that is still, that's pretty bad. And, but I worry about this stuff on the larger scale, like you were talking about, you know, if this is robotics seem to be coming along at an increasingly fast rate. Obviously these large language models are going to get better. The voice or the text to speech models are going to continue getting more and more realistic. And at some point, like it will be, we will be at that futuristic point where there are, and we're already seeing this, where they are coupling those things with crazy technology. And it is, I worry about what that does to the society, like the implications of that across the society, where you do see, because that again seems, instead of that being a slippery slope for an individual, it seems like that could be a very slippery slope from their perspective, just of us as a race.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it can further like feed into that anxiety. It's interesting. There's a book, I think it's called The Anxiety Generation. And they talk about like you notice a marked shift in like 2007, I believe, is when like the first iPhone was released, and people's experience of anxiety. And so how this like having these devices in our hands, like further that are supposed to connect us, have further separated us. And so, yeah, having these robots could do all sorts of cool things and like add to our lives in some way, but also further drives that wedge between us and other people.
Yeah, I want one of those Tesla robots for in my house. I was like, as an independent blind dude, that would be so helpful to have, like, all right, you're gonna be my eyeballs for while we clean the kitchen or whatever. But it's
right.
Yeah, there is. It's with everything, there's always positives and benefits that are positives and benefits. That's positives and negatives, where it is. That's another with the large language models we're seeing now, that there's some that are specifically meant to be an AI companion.
Mm-hmm. Right. I've already seen ads for like my like AI boyfriend on my social media.
That's going to draw people to a very, very dark place. Like, I don't see, that's one, like, I don't see that having a positive anywhere. Like, it's, again, maybe that initial dopamine fix where you are getting a connection, but like I don't see how that doesn't lead someone to a worse place. And I hate that there's a need for that. And those businesses should be able to have those businesses, right? Like, that is part of our society. But it does seem like there's a lot more room for harm to be done with all of that than for good. And it does, you know, if those models that those things are built upon start to get skewed, and we've already seen, I can't remember what the name of this company was, but there was one that I think it was a 13-year-old kid, the AI model, basically, as he was telling the AI model that he was depressed and all that stuff, and he didn't want to be here, and that he wanted to be with her. Like, the AI was supporting that, and he ended up killing himself because it was like, yeah, you know, if you go through with it, you'll be with me kind of thing. There was another one where it told this kid the steps to make a noose.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. It's I haven't heard of those.
Oh, that is dark. And it's like, I don't know. It's weird. I'm a huge proponent of all these technologies when used in the right way. It's like anything, but it's just, we are in such a weird freaking time with all these things. And I thought it would be, that's like part of the reason, or I guess a couple of the thousand things I wanted to talk to you about was just seeing if you're starting to see the impacts of these in your practice at all.
How AI is showing up is usually clients will tell me that they've talked through something with ChatGPT before they spoke to me. And the good thing is people are using, at least like the clients that I'm talking to, are using like some good discernment and like really thinking through what ChatGPT is putting out. So like the stories that you shared, I hadn't heard those, but there's one that like gets passed around in the Facebook groups where someone's using ChatGPT like a therapist. And then it said like to, you know, I'm hearing voices in my head, like essentially like, you know, using some, like highlighting some like schizophrenic psychosis. And the GPT encouraged them to stop taking their medication and like all this stuff, right? And so us as clinicians are worried that like it's going to be harmful. And so, but the clients that I see who come up to you are like, oh yeah, like I kind of like in between our sessions kind of like, you know, chatted with ChatGPT about this. And so I think it can be helpful. And that's the thing with why that was problematic, ChatGPT telling this person to stop taking medications, is I think what is problematic, but also a good thing about ChatGPT is it's like your biggest cheerleader. A lot of times the responses really just try to like say, yeah, that's a great idea, or like, you're doing awesome, which cheerleading is great unless you're being told to stop taking this medication that is really important for your brain functioning. Yeah. And so the clients will say like, you know, this was helpful, and also like, I want to bring it to therapy. And so it allows us to then work through that together with myself as a real person and an actual clinician to like work through what the, you know, GPT has spit out.
Yeah. And that's, I don't know, it is, it's tough, I guess, because a lot of this stuff, I guess that's almost a silly person or a silly question to ask. I was about to ask if, you know, you see, because a lot of this stuff, and I was going to say, because a lot of this stuff is sexual in nature, and it's not even necessarily that, it's a lot more relationships. If it's hard to get people to open up, but then I realize like the stuff that I've talked to my therapist about, all of it is typically hard to talk about. That's not like, that's just part of going to therapy. And that's, it was, I don't know. It just is, do you see, I guess, what, because it is a lot of times, I feel like it is almost different in a sense with the relationship side of things, because it is not just a, hey, this is what I'm going through, there's another person involved, or it is the lack of connection with another person. Do you see, I guess that's your whole field. So you've probably never really known any different than working in that lane. Is that correct?
But still, because sex is so taboo, and in the, like you said, like it, for most people, like therapy in general, it's like you're opening up with somebody whose job is to hold your secrets and to be able to support you through some of the darkest things that have happened in your life. With sex, there's another layer, just because sex is also so taboo. So it's interesting. I've had a lot of clients who, you know, I'm not their first therapist, because they felt like they couldn't talk about sex with the therapist. And so when they seek me out or they find me, they know like this is something in particular you absolutely can talk about. We're going to talk about it. It can be the focus of our work. I've had people, you know, not just reveal, you know, traumas, but like, you know, some of like their deepest fantasies that they've never told anybody. And just to like have a safe space to like say this thing out loud that not even another therapist knows, has been wonderful, just to really help people to reduce shame.
Is that one where they're the unexplored and maybe unsupported fantasies are a lot more common than most people would think?
Oh yeah. Yeah, actually, I have a video on deck about this one too. I love talking about sexual fantasy. So almost everybody has sexual fantasies. And most of them are not explored or acted upon. Like, you don't have, just because you have a fantasy doesn't mean that you have to act out on it. In fact, that's part of what can make it really exciting, is this thing that's like untouchable almost, or like maybe it's a fantasy that you have that in your brain sounds good but wouldn't work within the constructs of your relationship or within your relationship agreement. And so that's part of what makes it so exciting, right? There's this thing you call like the paradox.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, "I found it on The Real Real." Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Talks of eroticism, where what we find erotic is generally on the other side of some sort of barrier, right? So maybe I fantasize, and I say I, but this maybe isn't necessarily mine. But like maybe somebody fantasizes about like group sex, but they're in a monogamous relationship. So it's like, oh, I can't engage in this because we're monogamous, but that's part of what makes it hot. Or like they fantasize about being caught, and they would actually never want to be caught because they don't want to, you know, end up on a list somewhere. But just like the idea that you could possibly get caught is really exciting.
It's tantalizing. It's that naughtiness. Like we always, that's humans, is like, they're, what is that about us? That is a thing though. It is.
Yeah.
Like we shouldn't do that, you know?
Uh-huh.
So what is it about that that makes you, like you said, you love talking about it. What is it about it that draws you in specifically to that area of this whole thing?
Because it's so common and like so many people's fantasies, that if they realized how common these fantasies were, they would be like, oh my gosh, I'm just like one of, you know, thousands, right? And so Justin Lay Miller is a sex scholar at the Kinsey Institute, and he has done a lot of work in this field, and particularly has a book called Tell Me What You Want, where he interviewed, I think, 4,000 people about fantasies, like the largest scale study on folks with fantasies. And they broke down all the most common fantasies, percentages of types of fantasies, right? I know one person was like, oh, like one client of mine was like, I'm, you know, having a fantasy about my girlfriend's sister. And I'm like, let's see how common that is. Oh, like that's actually like 33% of men in this study have also had this fantasy,
Whoa.
Right? So it's not uncommon.
Yeah. Huh. Is that, I guess when they're researching something like that, obviously it would be like a questionnaire, but when like other, because like for you to get your PhD, you had to, like part of that is being a researcher. Like what areas were you researching? And do you, it doesn't sound like you still necessarily do research today. Is that correct?
No. Just like more so reading everybody else's research to inform my work. Yeah. My research, kind of bring it full circle to where I started, is I studied the role of sex toys in women's sexual trauma recovery.
Huh. Okay. What did you find?
What I found, so I'm looking at things as a clinician, right? So I interviewed women survivors of sexual violence who had different types of sexual trauma and who also use sex toys, and asked them about their experiences. And what I found is that their sex toy use aligned with a lot of other therapeutic modalities. So I found that they engaged in sexual use in a way that was like exposure therapy, where they, you know, maybe were not comfortable with a partner, but they started like exploring what they're on their own. And then they would use a vibrator while their partner's not in the same room, but like in the house. And then they work their way up to engaging in sex together. So like sort of like exposure therapy. Folks described it as a way to reconnect with their bodies, as like a mindfulness practice. People talked about it kind of aligning with CBT or cognitive types of therapies, in which they're challenging these maladaptive scripts. They would say things like, you know, it helped me realize that sex was safe, which challenges their belief that sex was unsafe, or help them to see that, build up this belief that sex could be for my own pleasure, as opposed to sex was only for the pleasure of this person who is perpetrating me. So it aligned with those cognitive ones. And it also helped people to feel empowered, right? Like, so thinking of sex toys as a symbol, you're literally putting an object that has power, if you're looking at a vibrator, into the palm of your hands. And it helps people to feel, when you think about empowerment, there are different ways to measure empowerment. But some of those are like feeling confident, feeling like they know their bodies, feeling like they could articulate what they liked to a partner. So having that interpersonal assertiveness was something else that they gained from the use of sex toys. And the best thing is that 100% of my participants identified that using a sex toy was helpful in their sexual trauma recovery. And the most common concern, as I was looking for any drawbacks, right, I wanted to make sure I was not just, you know, painting only a positive light. I wanted to know, like, what are some of the negative things that happened as survivors use sex toys? But the overwhelmingly most common response was, when the sex toy or when the vibrator dies before you're done, was the most common negative experience.
I didn't finish.
Yeah.
No. Okay. This is actually a question I was curious to ask you. And I was like, maybe this probably won't be a natural place to bring this up, but this might be, and you may not have the answer for this, but why is it so much harder for women to orgasm than it is for men?
But because women are more complicated. No, there's, I mean, our bodies are made up of the same tissue, right? But the way that it's placed is different. So having more externally visible anatomy as somebody who was, you know, has a penis, right? It can be easier to work with. Folks with vulvas and vaginas, right? The clitoris is made up of that same tissue that's on like the head of the penis. So it's still very sensitive, but people don't always know how to work with it as well, because it is not so easily exposed. And the other thing is, because the brain plays such a huge part in orgasm function, right? It's not just sexual stimulation. So when you say for women, right, people across sexes and genders can experience sex in different ways. But what tends to happen is people generally experience like sexual desire and arousal either spontaneously or responsively. Men tend to experience, or, you know, folks with male bodies, folks socialized as men, can experience spontaneous desire, where they feel that spark of desire and then arousal more spontaneously, whereas women tend to experience it more responsibly. And so sometimes that means that they need to have a physical stimulus to create arousal before that feeling of desire follows. So that's so part of it.
Yeah, we're starting with the engine warmed up, and you've been sitting in the garage in the winter.
That's what I say. I'm like, it's like a push to start versus like, you know, a classic over here that needs some warming up, right? Or like an oven versus a microwave, right? Yeah. Some folks heat up like microwaves, some heat up like ovens. They need to preheat. And then, yes, the mental component that happens with sex, folks who are socialized as women tend to carry this, what we call like the invisible load. And so whereas men who tend to be a lot more like visual and can stay like one track on like this naked body that's in front of them and be really excited about that, women might be there going, oh gosh, like, did I turn off the stove? I still need to do laundry. I have this deadline at work. And like all these other things that if you're not mentally there can make it a lot harder. And again, I'm using really big generalizations when I say like men versus women. So so it can totally be the reverse, right? Men can experience responsive desire. Folks with vulvas can be more spontaneous. And men can also have this mental load or to-do list, but that's just speaking in generalities.
Yeah, I think they would. I think most of the like, it's more common for it to be that way than not. Like just generally, but it's I think the tissue not being, I mean, basically being entirely external for men, and then almost almost nothing external for women. I never thought about that from the hardware perspective of it, but it does. Yeah, I don't. That was interesting. I'm so glad that there was a chance to bring that up, because I was like, I can't just wedge this in somewhere. But
well, and also just to like name like the tissue, right? So like the clitoris is external tissue. It's part of the vulva, right? The mm-hmm. vagina. I'll name all this because I think it's important in case people don't realize this. The vagina is specifically just like the canal, right? Like it's like where the baby comes from. But all those external bits are what composes the vulva. And so the clitoris is an external piece, but it can also be hidden under the hood and takes arousal for it to become erect. So just like penises become erect with arousal and blood flow, so does the clitoris, right? The more arousal, there's more blood flow. You might notice swelling and the clitoral erection. And the other thing that I think is really important is the internal structure of the clitoris. So most folks with vulvas experience orgasm through clitoral stimulation, but and I'll like show my little hand vulva for anybody who's watching, right? The part that is exposed is just the tip of the iceberg, this little like button here that you might see exposed. And the majority of the clitoris are these two legs that are actually underneath, like within the vulva, that you can't even you can't access externally.
Huh. Yeah, I guess
it looks like a wishbone. It looks more like a wishbone.
I never knew that.
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, because for people who don't realize, this is the first episode that will be video. And so we had talked beforehand about your, which was the perfect one for it to be the first one that's visual. But we were talking beforehand and you had told me like, hey, I don't know if you care about backgrounds, but I've got all these things in the background. And that's, I pictured you like going to your cabinet behind you and grabbing this like toy vagina or something. And I don't know. It was awesome mental imagery. Like you get a lighting up and being excited to show everybody. But
yes, I could totally show my plush vulva here, but yeah, I don't have. Everyone needs to like look up like the actual anatomical clitoris so that you can see it looks like a wishbone, but only that little top part is what you see exposed on the external part of the body.
Very, very interesting. Oh.
Which is why vibrators help for a lot of people, because it allows stimulation to the part that's hidden.
It travels down. Mm-hmm. Okay. Also didn't know that. Very, huh.
There you go.
What else? What other tips you got out there for people? I mean, I think now you don't have to do that, but it's, you know, I've wondered about this because it does seem, I think I know you mentioned that there are some people who are like sex is not really a part of their lives, but in most relationships, I would think that sex is a big part of a functional relationship and a good sign of a healthy one. And just is there any one big takeaway of like a something that starts on that path towards dysfunction in that area, or just not really basically like sexual inactivity in that area for people who are sexually active that starts down that path into leading into that space where there is now some disconnection in this relationship and you start to see the door open for infidelity, just kind of to bring things full circle as we start to bring this thing home.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are always concerned with how frequently you should be having, like, how frequently are people supposed to be having sex, and like, as that is a measure of a well-functioning relationship. I think what's most important is people being able to talk about this. A lot of times, like, when I see couples, the number one thing I see people for is desire discrepancy, meaning a mixed mesh desire. One person wants sex more than the other person. That is the number one thing that I see with people. And that's incredibly common. And it is almost unheard of to think that you and your partner are always going to have the same level of sexual desire. And so I think what's most important is being able to talk openly about that with your partner, so that way you can connect emotionally and then physically. So if you are noticing that you know, every time, let's say you're the one who experiences higher desire and you want to have sex more often, if you notice every time you initiate, your partner turns you down, and this has you feeling unheard. It makes people feel like I'm undesired, my partner doesn't find me attractive or something like that. I think it's important to voice those things and to like say like, hey, like, you know, every time you turn me down, I might be feeling this way. So that way you don't seek external validation, maybe, if we're talking about infidelity. But really, I think, yeah, people just need to be able to talk openly about these things. And if it's something that you've tried to address within your relationship and you feel like you continue to hit a wall, then I think that's, you know, a signal for you to talk to your partner about maybe seeking a professional, right? You would seek out a, you know, maybe a personal trainer if you wanted to get your fitness goals on track. And so if you notice you're having difficulty in tackling this with your partner, this area of your lives, then there are lots of us out here who would love to support you.
Yeah, I mean, it's so many things come down to communication. It's seems like it could fix a lot of issues, not just in relationships. I think in most places in the world, it would solve, especially with where we're at today, would solve a lot of issues. But I think it's important for people to hear that, where it is, you know, it doesn't have to be this very obtuse thing to fix. Like, there's a direct, very actionable, maybe not a comfortable thing to say, but it is a simple thing to say.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah, it can certainly cause a lot of emotions. And just to say too, like, you're on the other side of that. If you're the person who is experiencing the lower desire and you're turning your partner down, like, maybe it's helpful to seek out somebody who can help you explore your desire, and also maybe communicate to your partner that, like, well, yeah, because I've been here touched out by the kids all day. So by the time that you finally get home from work, the last thing that I want to do is touch another human being, right? So it's important to look at it from both sides. But yeah, there are lots of sex therapists that can help to facilitate that communication that can be so difficult because it is so emotionally loaded.
Last thing here, is that a common thing with where people are almost overstimulated, like physically overstimulated, and so that does drive a lack of physical intimacy?
Yeah, I hear it a lot with moms. Moms, we have, like, and I say we because I have a 2-year-old and a 3-month-old that are constantly clinging to me, right? Whether it's like to get milk from my body, or they just want to be held, or they want to like squeeze my face, you know, they want to climb all over you. And so, yeah, sometimes we get touched out, is like the phrase that we use, or like overstimulated from physical touch. That it's nice to have a break. And that's also like a lot of mental energy that goes into raising kids too. So that's something that certainly comes up.
That's another thing I've never heard and wouldn't have considered. The exhaustion part of raising kids, yes, that makes sense to me, but I'd never thought of the I'm just ready to not be touched. Like,
yeah,
totally makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you letting me lead you down all these different little rabbit holes, but where can, and it seems like a lot of it was actually very timely because you're going to have videos coming out for it, which is cool because we didn't talk about that. It just happened. Where all can everybody find you? Will you tell them again, just so, and I'll have all this stuff linked in the show notes. I think you already sent me a link to this stuff, but you want to tell everyone so they can hear it?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you, best place to find me is thehollywoodsexologist.com. And that's where I have all my private practice goodies and freebies. And if you want to go directly to YouTube, because you want to do a deeper dive on some of these topics that we brought up today, then you can check out The Hollywood Sexologist on YouTube.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks everyone at home for listening to another episode of Going In Blind. Again, please take a second to rate and review the show and share this around with another curious mind who needs to hear it. Go to my website if you're unfamiliar with my story. Read a little bit about it and join my mailing list if it sounds intriguing to you. Again, that is at zachtidwell.com. I've seen that sharing my story saves lives. And so I wrote a memoir about it to hope to continue doing that. And if you just listen to this and you want to see it, go check us out on YouTube. I've been there this whole time, but I haven't been posting video. So I'm very excited for this to be the first one. It really was the perfect episode to do it for. So we'll see you next time.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.